all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Colonel Samuel L. Russell, U.S. Army retired. Colonel, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. It's good to be with you today.
Well, we have you on not only because of your military experience, which I'll let the listeners know, you served 29 years in the U.S. Army. You're actually a fifth-generation Army officer. The family's got a deep, deep roots in the Army and other military fields. You let a brother go off to the Marine Corps. How did that happen? But we really have you on today not to talk about your experience in the Quartermaster Corps or in your overseas assignments, but to talk about an issue as a historian that's going on in Washington today, and it's related to the Battle of Wounded Knee back in 1890. So that we're going way back. But before we do, go ahead and give us just a touch of the family and personal military service, Sam.
Yeah, so I'm one of those families that, the sons end up doing what the fathers did. And that's gone on for, about five generations now. And so I have a connection to that Battle of Wounded Knee, and that I've got a great-great-grandfather that was one of the key officers that was in the Army at the time and at that battle. And so that's really my connection there. I'm a bit of a genealogist as well, and my tie or my interest in Wounded Knee really stemmed from my trying to understand my family and what they had done before me and how they had touched history. And obviously this was a big touch point that I have come back to again and again and again over the last two decades.
And that's really part of it here, is that as a military historian, you've written on a number of subjects, but this subject in particular, the Battle at Wounded Knee, you keep going back to. And you had to go back to it again this year because of a bill introduced into Congress, H.R. 3467, called Remove the Stain, which was asking the Congress to take up the issue of whether or not the men who were awarded medals of honor as a result of the Battle at Wounded Knee in December of 1890, whether those medals should be revoked. Have I summed that up right?
No, that's very good. And this has also been a cause that the Lakota Nation have taken up for about at least two decades, of seeing those medals as a stain on American history and on their heritage specifically, and they've done over the years a number of resolutions calling for those medals to be rescinded. I ended up getting involved because this is the first time where it has actually been written into language in Congress as proposed legislation, introduced at the end of June. So going back just a little over a month now, when it was introduced and referred to the House Armed Services Committee for consideration.
Well, it's pretty clear from the program prep that I've done that there's sort of a dispute as to the facts of what really occurred at Wounded Knee. The Lakota Nation has one viewpoint. I think the Army may have another. And you, writing as a historian, have a viewpoint. So why don't you go ahead and summarize for those who have heard of the Wounded Knee but don't really have a recollection of the history of what was going on at that time in December of 1890 and this particular engagement?
Yeah, so by 1890, most of the tribes were all at that point on reservations. You had a parceling of the Great Sioux Nation, the Great Sioux Reservation, which spanned the areas of the Dakota Territory, which now is North and South Dakota. In about 1889, there was work to a land act to try to parcel that up, reduce the lands. And they did by, I think 50 million acres or something like that, that ended up being freed up in a treaty that was signed by a number of tribes in 1889 that was put into effect in February of 1890. And that caused quite a bit of consternation, obviously, with the Clota people. There were some that signed. There were some that were vehemently against that. And another one of those instances where they felt perhaps cheated out of their land. It also was an area of 2 years in a row, or a time of 2 years in a row, when drought had hit the plains, and it hit the Dakotas especially hard. And so any crops that the Lakota were able to grow really were failing for 2 years in a row. You had coincidentally at the same time Congress taking action to try to wean the Lakota Nation off of much of the rations that they had been committed to, or that the government had committed to give them due to numerous treaties that they had signed. And so you saw a reduction in beef issues, a reduction in the expenditures for rations. And so all of those events kind of culminated in the summer of 1890 and just really made a desperate situation for the Lakota people. And one of the ways that that desperation materialized, I guess as a symptom you would say, it was a religious movement. It was called the Ghost Dance Movement, where the Lakota essentially were looking for a way to restore their lands before the arrival of the white people, that some of their warriors would come back, that the plains would be repopulated with buffalo and other game. And the movement really took off amongst the Midwest tribes, really all of the tribes, the Cheyenne and the Lakota, really grasped onto this religion to the point that it was disturbing to the Indian agents. They felt that their Indian their Indian keep, that their charges were out of control. And so they called for, in the fall of 1890, military intervention. They felt the only way they could get control of the reservations and the Indians there, to get them to stop dancing, is what they called it, was to bring the military in. And so the campaign was put in charge of Major General Nelson Miles, who was the commanding general of the Division of the Missouri. The president told him to prevent any outbreak and do it without any bloodshed if possible, but to ensure that no settlers were endangered. And so there was a very large buildup, and actually the largest military buildup, if you will, since the Civil War.
So was the
ultimately
was
ended
the...
up involving about a third of the field army, across the infantry, the cavalry, and the artillery. I want to say there was about 6,000 plus troops that were moved to the area, in addition to the 5,000 or so that were already there. So it was for a very small frontier army. It was a huge, massive deployment of resources to try to prevent this movement, this religious movement, from turning into an Indian outbreak.
So this was what, a show of force designed to kind of quiet things down? Hey, there's such overwhelming force here. We're just, you know, the Lakota people have to pull back. Is that what was going
on?
Sure.
It started small, and it was essentially a go to the reservations and protect the agencies. And so you had troops that began to arrive at the Pine Ridge Agency and the Rosebud Agency and the Standing Rock Agency. And then as more troops arrived, they began to obviously move into a more aggressive stance of, all right, now let's go out and get all the Indians and get them back onto the reservations. And just as with any force deterrent option, it sometimes has the opposite effect. Instead of deterring, it exacerbates. So you could say that's some of what happened here. But about the middle of December, there was an effort to go ahead and arrest Sitting Bull. Both the Indian agent there and General Miles wanted him arrested and removed from the situation. They saw him as a spark that could set the thing off, and they wanted to get him out of that picture. And during that arrest, it went awry, and you ended up with Sitting Bull being killed, along with a number of Indian police and some of the members of Sitting Bull's band. And then that caused the rest of his band on the Standing Rock Reservation to flee that reservation, and really set into motion a number of events that tragically would end up in a large number of deaths. For a band of Mini Kanju Lakota and part of Sitting Bull's Hunkpapa Indians that were killed at Wounded Knee.
And Wounded Knee occurred roughly 2 weeks after the attempt to arrest and ultimately the death of Sitting Bull. To put this into some context, so what sort of the U.S. Army 7th Cavalry then went to Wounded Knee Creek and sought to what move the Indians?
Well, so to give you as brief I can explanation, so you had a band of Indians, many Kanju Indians under Bigfoot. They had been actually under observation by the Army since about the previous April, so almost 9 months now. The Army element that was in charge of that area had Bigfoot's band under observation because he was perceived to be causing problems for the Indian agent there. And also because his village, when they redrew these reservation lines at the beginning of 1890, his village actually fell off the Cheyenne River Agency. So it was in an area that potentially could be sold off to settlers. And so they wanted to make sure there wasn't a problem with settlers coming in and exacerbating the situation. So they put about four companies of infantry and cavalry to watch his band over the course of 9 months. And it ended up being his band that ultimately was wiped out at Wounded Knee. When the Sitting Bull elements fled from the Standing Rock Agency, there was a large number of them, about 30, 35 of them, that ultimately linked up with Bigfoot and his band at their village. Right about the time that the 8th Cavalry was trying to convince Bigfoot to come in peacefully to Fort Meade and surrender. And it was the combination of those elements meeting and the Army moving in closer to his band then caused them to decide to flee south towards Pine Ridge, which was about 100 miles away. And so then you had this band that General Miles had asked to be captured and taken to Fort Meade suddenly fled the area. The Army viewed that as them breaking out, potentially to raid the settlers in the area, and ultimately to link up with another group of Indians that were held up in defensive positions in what was called the Stronghold. It was a large flat mesa area that offered great natural fortified positions for the Indians to fight from. And so they're really concerned that this band of many Kanjus under Bigfoot and the elements of Sitting Bull's Hunkpapa band would link up with these Brule Indians that were from the Rosebud element in the Stronghold. And they wanted to prevent that. So they had a number of cavalry elements. Colonel Eugene Carr's 6th Cavalry was out there. Lieutenant Colonel Sumner's 8th Cavalry was out there. You had elements of the 9th Cavalry under Colonel Guy Henry that were all out seeking to find Bigfoot's band and prevent them from linking up with his elements in the Stronghold. It turns out they weren't going there at all. They were trying to get to the Pine Ridge Agency. And when it became apparent they probably weren't going there, they sent the 7th Cavalry out a little bit further to the west from where the Stronghold was to try to find this band and prevent them from getting into Pine Ridge, because they didn't want those elements messing up with the peace efforts they were making with this other group of Indians. And ultimately that's where the conflict came in, as the 7th Cavalry eventually did find and accept the surrender of Bigfoot's band. They had been camped out. The cavalry had been camped out on Wounded Knee Creek. It was called the Post Office Crossing of Wounded Knee, and it was a road that went to the Pine Ridge Agency. They brought the Indians back to Wounded Knee Creek, to where the cavalry was encamped. They called for reinforcements to double their firepower, essentially as a show of force. They wanted to ensure that the Indians realized that they were overwhelmed, both in numbers and firepower. So essentially you had two battalions of the 7th Cavalry and a battery of artillery surrounding what was about somewhere between 350 and 370 Indians from principally Bigfoot's band, and convince them to surrender their arms.
And history will never be able to sort out exactly who started what, just as the information about how many died where seems confusing reading it 125 plus years later. But clearly what ended up happening is that overwhelming force, and it ended up wiping out pretty much all of that band of that were of Indians that were at Wounded Knee.
Yeah, so I would say almost like any battle, you have as many perspectives as you do players, and then certainly you have two very differing perspectives from the different sides, you know. And so if you were to look at a modern day battle today, the way what we would call the enemy would see the battle would be different, very different from the way we see the battle, not only because they're looking at it from a different perspective, but they have their own worldview. They have their own understanding of the motivations that brought them there and what brought their opposing force there. And so you end up, I think, with any event, two very different opposing views.
And that's really what we have going on now. It's we have one segment saying, hey, this is the Battle of Wounded Knee. The another segment saying, no, it's the massacre at Wounded Knee. And because it was a massacre, giving any military awards out is against the country's principles, and the 20 Medal of Honors that were awarded at Wounded Knee should be withdrawn. And that's what this Remove the Stain Act is about. You've written to the House Armed Services Committee as an individual, as a historian, telling them why that sort of retrospective look today with today's standards would simply be wrong. And here on Veteran Radio, we have Colonel Russell spoken a number of times with folks about the Medal of Honor and how the criteria for the Medal of Honor has changed over time, and that today's modern Medal of Honor is nothing like what it was during the Civil War, the Indian Wars, prior to, say, World War I or World War II. So talk to us a little bit about that retrospective look and why you think it's inappropriate for Congress to take on this action, although it's being implored to do so by many of the Lakota Nation supporters.
Sure. So let me first say, Wounded Knee was unique in the Indian Wars in that the commanding general was extremely upset with the result. He did not like the number, specifically the number of U.S. casualties under the conditions. So you ended up with, I think, by about the second or third day, you had 25 that died. Ultimately, you had about five more that died of wounds. I think it was 30 in all that were could be related to having been killed there. That's soldiers. That was a high number, and General Miles was not happy with that. So he initiated an investigation within days of Wounded Knee occurring. And it was investigated, essentially gaining testimony from just about every officer who was on the battlefield. And that's very unique to go back and find sworn statements within days of the battle from the officers who participated. And so what you have is an extremely detailed view of what the Army, at least the soldiers who fought there, believed happened at Wounded Knee. And you don't get that in just about any other Indian perspective. You have people trying to piece it together months after, once the campaigns are over, and often it's newspaper reports or it's letters. It's not sworn testimony. And so what you have is a very detailed record taken within a week or two of the battle. They actually go out and they survey the battlefield and they map the whole battlefield and they map out where the Indians were and where the soldiers were. And so you have this very detailed record that you get with almost no other battle across the Indian Wars. You have also what occurred after every major Indian Wars battle. The U.S. Army soldiers that were involved in that recognized those who they felt were heroic. And so with Wounded Knee, you end up with ultimately 30 medals that are awarded across the campaign. And of those, I want to say 23 of them specifically went to the 7th Cavalry or the 1st Artillery for either Wounded Knee or White Clay Creek, which was a small skirmish or battle that happened the following day. And it seems like, you know, you hear the number 23 Medals of Honor. That's huge. But when you consider that there's no Bronze Star, there's no Silver Star, there's no Distinguished Service Cross, there actually was a very detailed study done on the medals from the Little Bighorn, which are about the same number. I want to say there was 24 there. And compare that to World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Korea. And it comes out about the same percent, about 10% of soldiers that are serving at the time of a conflict, whether they're involved in it or not, ultimately end up receiving some sort of valorous award. Now, obviously, since World War I, those are other medals. They're medals of honor, but they're also Distinguished Service Crosses. And then later you have the introduction of the Silver Star or the Bronze Star. And so the numbers really are not out of whack with how we see medals awarded today. You also, if you looked at other battles, you would find similar numbers. I want to say there was, 24 at the Little Bighorn. I think in the 80s, the number of medals that were awarded for the Little Bighorn campaign that spanned that whole year. You have, I want to say there was a battle with the Apaches that was 32 medals of honor for one single day's action. That involved two troops of cavalry and only two soldiers were killed. And so those high numbers of medals of honor are not out of the ordinary for the time period in the era. The Medal of Honor obviously had a different meaning at the time to the soldiers. If you read the newspaper accounts of soldiers receiving the Medal of Honor, it's clear that the civilians don't really know or understand what the Medal of Honor is yet. It does not have the prestige that it gains later. There are no White House ceremonies with the president presenting this medal. They are engraved and then mailed to the unit, and the unit presents it however they want to, usually in a formation, sometimes on a parade field. There's at least one picture that is taken of a Medal of Honor ceremony that I want to say it's the 2nd Battalion does while they're in the field in the summer of 1891, and it's on horseback where they go up and present a Medal of Honor. And it may be the first photograph of a Medal of Honor presentation, and that's to First Sergeant Frederick Toy receives a Medal of Honor.
Let me move you on to because I want to get to this before we run out of time. And that's the concept that we ought to look back and remove Medal of Honor recipients. It's been done before. We've removed Medal of Honor recipients when the Army or DoD has decided that, hey, these guys got him for signing up versus really a valor, although the criteria was different. But this concept that we would have the adversary, in this instance, the Lakota Nation, be pushing for removal because of what happened to them, puts a whole nother interesting twist on it. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, so probably my biggest concern with this is the precedent that would have set, in that you start to look at medals of honor that have been awarded in the past, not just from the perspective of the soldiers who fought there, which is how every medal is awarded. Every medal is based on soldiers saying, here's what happened on the battlefield, U.S. soldiers. There's not a single medal out there where we've gone to the other side and asked our opponents, what do you think about who should get medals? And so it's a difficult situation in that the Lakota Nation, they're obviously U.S. citizens now, and very productive members of society. They're veterans. They've served in wars. They've received medals themselves. And they clearly have a strong emotional tie to Wounded Knee and want these medals rescinded. But it really would be looking at the perspective of the adversary the Army faced in 1890 and asking them whether they think it's appropriate to award medals. And that's, I think, a very slippery slope, a very steep slippery slope, that once you've done that, you then open up to any faction in future generations to question any medal that's ever been awarded. So if you have a faction of a Muslim community in the United States who disagrees with the reason we fought in Iraq, they then start lobbying to rescind medals from Iraq. Apply that to Afghanistan. If we went to the descendants of survivors of the city of Dresden and asked them whether the valorous awards that the Army Air Corps pilots received when we firebombed that city, obviously that would be a very different perspective. And so to me, that's the concern in this case, is that we really start to look at battles from our adversary's perspective and then start questioning whether medals should be awarded or not. That's a pretty slippery slope.
Well, and that's exactly why we asked Colonel Samuel Russell, retired from the U.S. Army and historian who has focused for over two decades on the Battle of Wounded Knee, to talk to us, is because of that issue, that where it goes into the future. Sam, can you tell folks how they might be able to read your submittal to the House Armed Services Committee and how they might be able to keep an eye on what's going on this issue?
Sure. So I've had a blog, website, if you will, for about 6 years now. It's called armyatwoundedknee.com, where I go out and present the perspective, usually primary sources, letters, diaries, sworn testimony, reports, etc., on what the Army's actions were at Wounded Knee, what brought them to Wounded Knee, and what the soldiers say happened out there. And when I wrote the House Armed Services Committee now about 3 weeks ago, I took a copy of that letter and posted that. So that's currently my most recent post. So if you went to just armyatwoundedknee.com, that's the first thing that would come up, setting the record straight regarding H.R. 3467 and Remove the Stain Act. And it's, to be honest, one of the lengthier posts. It ended up being about 53 pages, the letter in length of analysis. Because what I did was go into the actual Medals of Honor, the 23 that were awarded, and I went into the National Archives and I found the letters that the company commanders wrote recommending their soldiers. So where you may see a citation on the, if you looked up one of the Medal of Honor recipients, it will say for bravery. But obviously the commander wrote a lot more than that. And so you start to get a more detailed understanding of what those soldiers did at that battle. And then I also talk about some of the actions that were taken in 1916 and 1917 when Congress asked the War Department to relook its Medals of Honor. It gives a little bit of the precedent set there and some of the thoughts from that board and the results they came out with.
It's really well written and it's really well researched, and that's why we asked you to come on and talk about it a little bit, Sam. We appreciate the level of interest that you have in this and the passion you've put on it. I encourage everybody to go and take a look at this. And when you do, then you probably ought to talk to your U.S. congressman about your thoughts on this particular proposed bill and whether or not, as the colonel says, it's historically deficient. And make up your own mind and have those kind of discussions. We're glad to be this thought-provoking on this sort of interesting issue, because it not only looks backward to 1890, but as you say, you make this precedent now, you're going to be revisiting the awards for valor that are given out in Iraq and Afghanistan and Germany and Japan and Vietnam and other conflicts. So it's definitely worth giving some thought to, and we appreciate you taking some time today on Veterans Radio to give us your perspective.
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity, Jim.